Are you ready?
Okay, Smokey. Roll 'em. That's silly. Shoot him now! Shoot him now!
I gotcha!
Hello, everyone, and welcome to That's Not Quite All, Folks, the Looney Tunes podcast. I'm your host, Mark Hallam, joined by...
And I'm Jordan Schmidt, and with this episode, we are rectifying... Because we recently did a lot of, like, a collection of one-shots from X-Director, and we did a Frizz one and an Arthur Davis one. Well, not an Arthur Davis one. We did an Arthur Davis episode, and we did a Kimson one for some reason. But... we didn't have time to do a Chuck Jones one in that one. And so we figured, let's cover some more self-contained Chuck Jones cartoons. Because at the very least, they'll be inspired. Because it's Chuck Jones. And, you know, he's great.
And boy howdy, are these shorts very much inspired choice. These are three very interesting cartoons. In a number of ways that we'll get into. So the ones we are covering this week are Rocket by Baby, Nelly's Folly, and Another Froggy Evening.
Yes. I will admit that last week when you announced what these were, I had to make sure that we didn't already cover Rocket by Baby because I had mistook it for Martian Through Georgia. But no, we hadn't, and we're doing it today, and that'll be interesting, as opposed to the other ones that are also... these are three extremely interesting shorts that we're covering today. Like, there's a lot going on in these. It's not just like... Because last week we had a very easy... okay, here's a Wile E. Coyote cartoon. Here, you know, these are pretty disposable. Like, and these are like... there's so much bigger things afoot. Including, of course, you know... and we were talking about this before we got on. The sequel... to one of Chuck Jones's triumphs, which is also one of his last epics, in a sense.
Yeah.
So, there's lots going on.
Yeah, so we're going to be taking a look at those today. Yes.
All right. So I have the first one, and the first one here is Rocket by Baby, which was released on August 4th, 1956, which is weird, because we're recording this on August 3rd. That happens sometimes.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah. Couple interesting on this day, as I found for this one. Elvis Presley releases Hound Dog, so one of his biggest songs. So he just releases that one in a while. Hadn't charted yet, but you know, there it is, Hound Dog, it's out there. Interesting birthday on this day. Businesswoman Meg Whitman, who is most relevant to the fields of entertainment studies because she was the CEO of Quibi, was born on this day.
Oh.
Remember Quibi?
Yeah, she... now, I will say, she did used to run... was it HP or Dell?
One of the
computer companies.
And she tried running for mayor of LA as well, and that didn't go well.
And yes, she also did Quibi. Which, listen, 2020 was a very fascinating time in the world of technology. A lot of people did new things. We did a Looney Tunes podcast. They launched a streaming service with a bunch of celebrities. If you told me it's the Looney Tunes podcast that's still going, I would be surprised. I wouldn't be too surprised, honestly.
It was weird because, like, you know, Katzenberg helped run it, and they had all these big stars, and they wanted to make something of it. But it was weird how badly the business model went, because the whole thing was, it was like, okay, these big stories, but only in like less than 10-minute bites, because that was the intention span that the focus groups thought that people had. When in reality, it wasn't like that, and people wanted more actual episodes of these. So it was trying to appeal to the TikTok generation, and it failed miserably, especially because of pandemic things.
Oh, yeah, that was the best part of it, because they're like, oh, you know, something to watch when you're on a train, riding in a bus, on your commute to work. When you're launching this, at a time where nobody can go on a train, no one can go on a bus, and nobody can go to work. And it was so bad. And the only bright spot, is that the company Roku, who brought us Weird, the Al Yankovic story, among that.
Yeah.
They pretty much bought all Quibi stuff. Yeah. So it's not lost media.
No.
Which you could argue more companies maybe should just buy their stuff and sell it to Roku if that's the case.
Yeah. I mean, it's ensuring that it'll still be on a service. And Roku seems to have their shit together.
Yeah. I'm looking at the Roku City right now.
Yeah. What Roku's doing, which is pretty cool, is that, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they stitched together a lot of these Quibis into the full features and or, like, regular-sized shows that they should be. So you can actually watch things like the Most Dangerous Game or the reboot of The Fugitive or Die Hard.
And I remember the big one was Reno 911 because they brought that show back. And that show is very much a comedian's comedian show.
Yeah, it's The Remains of the State.
Yeah, so they did Quibi, failed, and then they got a Second Life. And now, you know, you can watch Thomas Lennon and Robert Ben Grant, the two writers who brought us now to the museum, just have fun with their old buddies again.
Yeah, no, it's nice. So for Rocket by Baby, this was...
Yes, that's right.
I think the only Chuck Jones, Michael Maltese joint venture we have here, because the rest are written by other people.
Yeah.
Although, of the two Golden Age shorts we have here, this is the only one that doesn't feature Mel Blanc. He was out that day. And so we have Dawes Butler and June Foray doing all the voices. And again, these are two people they were working with a lot at the time. Dawes Butler and June Foray were a big part of the Honey Mousers series. Dawes Butler was also on hand to do a Groucho Marx impression in Widow Rabbit. This is pre-Yogi Bear Dawes, but he's still pretty reliable in this era. Same with June Foray. Right. But yeah, no Mel here.
So Dawes Butler, he's also the narrator in this, right?
Yeah.
I know you just praised the guy, but when the narrator starts in on this short, I went, he sounds like a tired John Lovitz.
This is the planet Mars. In the summer of 1954, this planet passed extremely close to the Earth, so close that a cosmic force was disturbed. And a baby intended for the Earth was delivered to Mars, while a Martian baby went by mistake to the Earth.
So maybe he shouldn't have narrated them. Maybe they should have gotten Robert Bruce or somebody, you know. But yeah, this opens with a narration thing that explains that at some point in 1954, there was a cosmic mistake. And, you know, a baby that was heading for the Earth was collided with a baby that was heading for Mars, and the two switched places. And while it doesn't explain exactly how babies are, like, flying from outer space onto Earth, that's, I think, a different cartoon. What we do have here is, like, some really good opening animation and backgrounds. And it gives the sense of a cooler-looking cartoon. But then we get to Earth and all the people look really stylized and lower key and not as impressive as you would think for Warner Brothers.
As we'll later learn with the next cartoon, they could look worse.
Yeah, but these are almost knowingly kind of blotchy, and I get the sort of stylization that he's going for, perhaps over-stylization. It's not ideal for me, and I think it does take some of the legitimacy out of this one, but, like, I can see it working for some people. You know, it's like some deliberately stylized and downtrodden Pixar designs. It's like, okay, I see what you were trying to do, even though it's not, like, really going for the likeness. But yeah, you know, we center around this family. You know, it's Dawes Butler as the father, who's waiting in the hospital waiting room to see his child. And due to the mix-up, we have him taking home this Martian child. And again, like, per my earlier point, the stylization works when it's houses and buildings and things, because a lot of those look really cool. You know, the street they're on and, you know, seeing the outside of their house and what it all looks like. But the people, I'm just taken aback a little bit. except ironically for the animation of the baby, who, yeah, that's how it should be done. But yeah, no, we have some pretty basic setups here. We have, you know, the father taking the baby for, you know, a walk around the neighborhood and trying to get him out in the open, even though obviously, you know, he's green, there's something different with him. And I do like the animation of the baby coming from around the carriage and scaring the father, and then like his antenna going up and trying to talk to one of the bees, and which leads to the very, very, very good line.
But darling, we can't have him talking to any strange bee he might meet on the street.
I especially liked the kind of the slouch look of the father as he's pushing the Martian son. Like, kind of like making sure that nobody sees that this is what he's doing.
Yeah. It's the '50s, everybody judges. So
yes.
But yeah, no, it's a lot of things where it's setting up, you know, him in town and how things are different because of this like advanced alien specimen. Like they run into an old lady who is it's voiced by June Foray doing her granny voice. It's weird hearing a granny voice coming out of a different looking old lady.
Yeah. Why couldn't it have been granny? It would have been fun.
Yeah, but you know, a Frailing unit versus Jones unit, you know.
No, you know, just walking Sylvester or something.
It'd be cheeky, but I don't think Jones was going to do that.
No.
I wouldn't let him. But this whole bit is really good. It's just the slow realization of you know, because the old lady is complimenting the baby, you know. Such a healthy-looking green baby, too, stops, eye darts to us. That's good. And then as the father and the child they go back home, we just have the old lady standing stock still, putting out a little kazoo and tuning a note, and then screaming in that note.
Yeah.
That is perfect.
A fantastic June Foray scream. Really good. Yeah. Really good job.
There's a reason they kept using her through the rest of the 50s. But I also laughed at just how they basically show the advancement of this alien baby as it goes along. Like you know, it gets home and the wife goes, "He's doing your income tax." And the reveal of him literally just at a keyboard doing taxes, like you know, just a baby, an alien baby doing taxes. That's silly enough.
Yeah.
But you just get all of these little examples of the advanced nature of the kid, which are amusing. Like, you know, the whole model of the solar system and all these different, like, EMC squared in the blocks. And they're all right until we get to hurricane possibilities for the year 1985.
And for those keeping home, there was Hurricane Bob, Hurricane Claudette, Hurricane Danny, Hurricane Elena, Tropical Storm Fabian, Hurricane Gloria, and Hurricane Juan, and Hurricane Kate.
Again, as they get more and more bizarre, I love, you know, the little schematics. How to build a better mousetrap, how to build a better mouse.
A better mouse.
What I love about all of this is as they show how advanced the child is, it's a lot like what I said about Martian Through Georgia, in that there is definitely some, without even meaning to, there is some, this is very neurodivergent culture where it's like, okay, and very advanced child completely reconstructing the world around him and nobody really getting it. I was like, okay, I can relate to that. So it's really cool. That theme has aged really well. But yeah, no, just... It's not even comical, a lot of this. It's just really impressive and cool, just him being the... Like, again, the bit we have next where it's a kid seeing a spaceship on television, and as the rest of the television program plays in the background, you just see him measure it and basically make it in real time. It's not funny per se, but it's an ingenious piece of character growth, and it's a really cool thing to see animated.
And I believe, yeah, at this time, we go out to space and we see something is coming to Earth as we find out that it's a rocket. And I do love the line, because you know the rocket knocks on the door, and rings the doorbell, the husband gets it, sits down, she's like, "Oh, who is it?" It's like, "Oh, nothing, just a rocket from a spaceship from Mars." And the mother going, "Oh good, I thought it was a letter from my aunt or something."
That's great.
Sound like really good, which is nice. And then just the realization, like, where did I...
Wait, Mars. And so...
Mars!
Honestly, for a 7-minute cartoon, the kid flying off right when it becomes most advantageous for him to stay there for the parents is fantastic structuring. Because, of course, the note says, hey, we have your kid named Yob. This is our son that you have there named Mott. Tom and boy backwards. And we want to do an exchange, so keep him there and make sure nothing happens to him, and we'll be over in a little bit. And of course, this is the exact moment where the kid flies out the window in the spaceship he just made. And that's great structuring there. And just him flying throughout the city as the parents start running through yelling Mott, which I think you enjoyed.
Yeah, because it's so silly. You know, it's like because it's a serious situation, but they have to say something stupid the entire time. It's like, what? My favorite joke in this entire thing is where Maude goes into a scientist, and he's pretty much doing a TED Talk.
We are a nation of nervous, foolish children. We dream up little green men from Mars. We imagine there are flying saucers. Flying saucers. Green men.
Sobbing. And also, that lecturer might be the best designed person in the whole cartoon.
Yeah, yeah.
What ends up happening is that, you know, I do like how it ties up where the spaceship from earlier just sort of collects Mott and begins to fly off as the father, like, falls from several stories, still wanting his kid and yelling about Yob or whatever.
And, Yob! Where's my Yob?
Yeah. It's very silly. And Dawes Butler, of course, brings it. It does lead to a It's All a Dream ending where he's still in the waiting room thinking of all the horrors of what might be, especially with the space paranoia of the time multiplying it. It does feel slightly like a cop-out, like especially whenever a cartoon does a It's All a Dream thing and doesn't really own a lot of the amazing thing that's happened. Decent ending beats because, you know, the baby comes out with a bracelet around him that says Yob, even though it just says boy backwards. You know, so that's a decent ending. But I wish it would have committed to the insanity that it was presenting to us. But, you know, they were trying to do a more sensible anxiety about parenting kind of thing, which in that case works a lot better than Google Goliath. But this one had a lot of impressive ideas that I did like. I mean, in my opinion, this is a story that would have been great in a larger, fleshed out film with a bigger animation budget. But as is, the more stylized designs of the people in it bring things down slightly. There are still a lot of great ideas here. I do like the almost novelty of it being a Dawes Butler and June Foray without Mel kind of cartoon. It's good. It's not perfect. There are some things I wish were different, but I enjoyed.
Yeah, I really like the story in this. I find the dynamic between between all the characters to be a lot of fun. There's some really great jokes in here. Like I said, the scientist is a lot of fun. Yeah, I just love the delivery with the granny as well as with the, you know, he's doing your income taxes. It's very just, it's like it's trying to present like a horror movie at certain points, like a creature from our space film, but just the most mundane shit because it's just a baby.
I love that.
Which I really enjoyed. Yeah, and I found the ending to be really nice. You see, and you put it together like, oh, because he's looking in the mirror, so it's reflective, right? Right, that actually came up with it. Like, it wasn't actually, because I came up with, I thought it did happen, and that's actually Yob.
Okay, well, that's also a valid interpretation. I was just being a square.
It's like, oh, it's just a dream, or is it?
Yeah, that's probably what it was, but I don't know.
I don't know.
Who's to say? It's ambiguous, but it's a better ending than Joker.
I'll get the Ouija board.
No, don't, not literally, not Little Richard. We're trying Little to talk Richard, to Chuck about his cartoons. Why do you keep interjecting with fast food? I think you know why.
I'm loving it.
Ba-da-ba-ba-boo!
Okay, well, what rating are you giving this?
3.5 out of 5.
And that's also why I'm giving this short. Yeah. I mean, this 3.5 out of 5 animals.
Yeah.
My gosh. All right. And now to cover the most adult Looney Tunes cartoon ever made, according to Looney Tunes Twitter. All right. So this year is Nelly's Folly. It came out on December 30th, 1961. In regards to what happened on that day, I only wrote this down because we have the runner about the president of the Philippines, but a new president of the Philippines,
Diosdado Macapagal,
was sworn to office as the new president of the Philippines. Hopefully he didn't try, hopefully he didn't get whacked on a golf course. I looked up his Wikipedia, he died of natural causes.
Right.
So
you really... And this goes back to the Filipino golf course one, but yes, you really, yes. Knowing what I know about that one, you really used the term get whacked when it was literally called whack whack.
Yes.
They don't get whacked if they die there. They get whack whacked.
Exactly. Yes.
Exactly. Oh, God.
All right. So this short was directed by Chuck Jones, co-directed by Maurice Noble and Abe Levitow.
Yeah.
It's a group effort. Story by David Itagi and Chuck Jones. Okay, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
One of the few times where the end times worked with him. What's odd about this cartoon is that it's not a comedy. There's no slapstick jokes in this.
Right.
It's a drama.
Yeah.
About a singing giraffe.
Yeah. Didn't this one get nominated for an Oscar?
It did.
Because this is like the Oscar baitization of cartoons. Like, even they're trying to do dramas to get Oscars.
That's actually a pretty good point.
Yeah.
All right. So. Oh, I'm sorry. It was actually just one.
Yeah.
The nominees for 1961, pretty packed Warner Brothers year, because I think even then we're like, this is our last chance. We this is our best stuff. They're going to shut us down. So the nominees that year were from Fritz Freeling's division, the Pied Piper of Guadalupe.
Yeah.
From Chuck Jones, a double feature of Beep Prepared. And Nelly's Folly.
Yeah, we like Chuck Jones cartoons.
That's a nomination. And also from the Walt Disney division, we've got Aquamania, which is a goofy cartoon. And what one was a short called Monroe from the
Czechoslovakians, Mark?
Yes, Czechoslovakians. Those darn Czechoslovakians won it.
Yeah. A country that no longer exists.
Yes. Do you think this was the final straw at WB?
We're losing to the fucking Czechoslovakians.
Like,
what's the point of this?
Are you kidding me? We lost to the Czechs? We're closing it down.
The check better be in the mail. Thank you.
Other fun facts. This short is one of the few Warner Bros. Cartoons that has more than one person credited for voices. Mel Blanc is credited, of course. He has some voices in this. But the main star is Gloria Wood. She voices Nelly in this cartoon. She was a famous session of vocalist. She had some pretty famous roles. I think, you know, she voiced the original Rice-A-Roni TV jingle.
Right alone, the San Francisco Creek. Right alone, everybody's got to be. Started out where cable cars played a song. Not right at home, because very long. Right alone, the San Francisco Creek. From San Francisco, famous for food, comes Rice-A-Roni, the exciting new side dish.
She was a vocalist for Kay Kacer's The Woody Woodpecker song.
Oh, that's the Woody Woodpecker song. Yeah, he's a pecking it all day long. He pecks a few holes in a tree to see if a redwood's really red. And it's nothing to him on the tiniest whim to peck a few holes in your head.
And, this is very interesting, dubbed the singing voice of Vera Ellen, Betty Grable, and Marilyn Monroe.
Oh.
So yeah, she, she did chorus work for Disney. She did a lot of stuff in the entertainment industry in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. So yeah, she has the lead role in this as the talented singing giraffe. All right, so I think I'll get into the plot now. We'll get to the scandal when we get there.
Scandal.
Tonight on Inside Edition. That's basically what it is.
Alright, so our short begins with narration. We're in the jungle, and there's a lot of like dangerous sounds.
Mighty jungle.
Exactly.
Oh, I'm sleeping.
There's a lot of dangerous sounds and creatures in the jungle. At least any sound could be attributed to a dangerous beast. And then we hear Nelly.
Hi.
Come on, you were all thinking it.
We had to get that joke out of the way now, or else we would have never done it. So, now Nelly is a wonderful singing giraffe. And she's singing, you know, this beautiful song, and all the animals are sitting on the ground looking up at her because she's so damn tall. But she has a lovely singing voice. And when she's done singing her song, a man from the safari, who's not Colonel Rimfire, though holy shit, I'll fight without have been.
No. No. No Colonel Rimfire in this. No Frizz trying to sing like, hey, what if we put this guy? No, I'm doing mine. But it'd be fun. No, dude, I'm trying to create drama here.
Way to cartoons. Yeah, well, I'm trying to win us an Oscar. Anyways, it didn't fucking work. Anyways, so he's like, oh my god, come with me to Hollywood. We'll sign you up. You'll be a star. Everyone will love you. You have to go. So she signs a contract. Says goodbye to her friend. She's crying. They're crying. As we go into New York City.
Before that, there's a really beautiful shot of all the other animals waving goodbye. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It is. And as she goes to New York City into a recording session. And I love this. Well, because first of all, everyone's recording her. And there's a bunch of cameras. Yeah. And of course, there's like one guy holding up this long wooden plank that's tied to a microphone so she could sing Auld Lang Syne. And,
pretty much.
It's beautiful. Corey Watts is a very good singer. So it's a very wonderful version of the song. And I love the little gag where we cut to the TVs, and of course the TVs are lined up together to capture a full image, which is it's very nice.
Well, it's Auld Lang Syne, but it's for a commercial jingle, right? Isn't it selling like something? It's for Algonquin Rutabaga Tonic, which is a silly product to be hawking, to be fair, but I think they were also making fun of even 60s consumerism, which is very funny because we know that consumerism is crazy now, but like in the 60s they're like, yeah, maybe this is too much. But yeah, I love that immediately Nelly is used as the arm of corporations to sell products. Like, you know, sells out immediately. All right, we have this singing giraffe. Let's have her do commercial jingles. Like, that's how things worked then and now.
Yeah.
You know. And again, like, the bit with the several TVs is great.
Yes, as she does a live show, which is a lot of fun. I like that she's doing, like, a cowboy number. So, again, just all this fun stuff with giraffe stuff. Like, she has, like, a bunch of scarves on her neck as she sings this wonderful song about being a cowboy. And then we get this montage where we see she's on a magazine called
Wife Magazine.
Or fun side hustle, yeah.
Hello, and welcome to Wife Magazine. Huh? It's not my Elmer's not as good today, but
page 12.
Today we're going to be looking at wives. Not any of mine wives. I don't live in Utah.
No, it's bigger me.
I'm sure it is.
There's magazines and there's you know, these elaborate turtlenecks that make you look like a giraffe.
Giraffe necks. Giraffe necks are in, turtleneck sweaters are out, and we see a turtle reading a newspaper, turning to us and goes,
"Well, that's show business."
I love cartoons, man.
So then Nelly releases a lot of albums, albums such as
Music to Nick By.
They had fun.
They had so much fun.
Nelly's Blues, Nellyville, Sweat, Suit, Brass Knuckles.
Country Grammar, yeah.
I was trying to sneak that in there. Anyways.
Yeah. But then we get to the real meat of this.
So,
which is
Nelly's successful.
Nelly, yeah,
she has all this success, but as the narration tells us, with all the world at her feet, she's still alone. So she goes on her walk into the zoo. And... okay, let's see. That's the best way to put this.
That's, you know, to be honest, Mark, when they go to the zoo, I thought it was going to be like a different kind of thing. I thought it was going to be like, but she sees animals are caged and she wants to, you know, she complains like, you know, we need to save the animals. And then she ends up in the zoo. Like, because you see enough movies that are like this and you're like, okay, you see where it's going. But that's not where it went.
No.
It instead went towards adultery. And home wrecking.
Yes. As Nelly sees this man giraffe and immediately she's like, ooh, at first he's kind of animated, like he's a bad boy. So I'm like, ooh, Nelly, you.
Yeah.
But no, it turns out this boy giraffe is married to his wife, and we get this, you know, again, the narration, where it's like,
that settles it. And yet, when you're so lonely, and that wife so unchic.
What really got me going, what, is Nelly then stops, looks at the giraffe, and puts down her coat to reveal her shoulder, and that's just it. He just runs right at her, hearts going everywhere, as the newspapers start piling in.
I put in my notes here, Jesus Christ, they're really doing the giraffe affair thing? Like, part of me really likes that they kind of went there here.
Now, fun fact... This is actually a reference to real-life events. Yes, Chuck saw a giraffe one day and went, no. Well, apparently, this is a reference to Ingrid Bergman.
Oh, okay.
Who was shunned by, famous actress, was shunned by American audiences in 1950 for her scandalous affair with a married director, Roberto Rossellini.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she spent most of the 50s away from the United States. She married Rossellini in 1950 before divorcing him 7 years later. After she won the Oscar in 1957 for Anastasia, the 1956 adaptation, not the Fox animated movie. The scandal was largely forgiven by the public. And I was like, oh, that's right. We liked you. You can act. And also what I find so funny is like, you know, oh, isn't this crazy how in 1961 or whatever they're doing this, and we're sitting here like, yeah, this happens every single day. Like, how many times do random people turn on social media? It's like, why? Oh my god, they did what? Like, it's everywhere. It's still it's crazy.
The line that really struck me was,
the public will forgive anything in a star, but infidelity.
What I wrote in my notes here after that line was, oh my god, she's the original Ariana Grande.
Yeah. I wasn't going to say it, but you're absolutely correct.
Because the Ethan Slater thing's going on literally as we record this, so.
Shit. And some would argue she had the same features as a giraffe. You know, tall neck, ponytail.
Are you saying that giraffes pretend they're black as well? Oh, sorry, my mistake. She's pretending she's Asian now. I apologize.
Right.
Ari, you're fucking Italian. That's cool enough.
Yes. So, the one that I wrote down here was Nelly considering foreign role, which, again, that's just a direct Ingrid Bergman connection. You know, it's like, oh, leave the United States, go somewhere else. So, it's this very scandalous thing, and just, you know, she knew it was over when her new show opened, and I love the narration here, like, it was then... She had the worst thing that ever happened to an artist. An empty house. No one came.
I kind of love that. Yeah. Like that's the thing. It's you can tell this isn't a comedy because it gets like genuinely sad for her. Like, you know, this is also the part where the guy whose marriage he broke up is now back with his wife and thinking she's a has-been.
And we get this shot of Nelly on a bridge. And I wrote down here, Nelly's on a bridge. She's on a bridge. I'm like, how dark are we willing to go here? But no.
Well, considering we've already seen Bowery Bugs, like, that's it. They're not going to do that.
No. As, she's crying as we transition away from the ocean to find out she's back at the jungle. She's back at her roots, if you will.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's singing this, you know, this sad song, actually, because she's still, you know, she lost everything. As a male giraffe sings along with her, and they fall in love. And the story ends with Nelly finding another fellow giraffe and just having a happy ending. And you know it's a happy ending because not only is there the end, but there's also a end card I've never seen in my entire life, which is, you know, just a black screen and then just Merry Melodies, Fetal Warmer's cartoon, beautiful release, and that's it. There's no big that's all, folks. They just end it there.
It just ends like that.
And that moment, which, yes, the entire cartoon is also interesting and off-kilter for Warner's at this time, but that end card felt like a finale. It felt like that was an end to something. And, you know, I was looking up, because I'm like, okay, what? Because that seemed weird to me. Because, like, you know, like what's up with Doc? Same thing, you know, he wants that big epic ending. Now it just ends with just, that's all, folks, regular title card, but as a photo. So that way he doesn't mess the mood. This was completely different. So, you know, I had some, like, theories, you know, because, you know, oh, David DePatie helped write it. Maybe this was, like, a way to slowly get the next era starting. But I choose to.
Yeah. Oh, next era.
What I choose to believe. Because, you know, Merry Melodies at this point kind of came interspersed with Looney Tunes. You know, when they started Merry Melodies, it was for a point. You know, these are the cartoons that the Warner Brothers own the music rights to, and we're going to make cartoons based on the music so that you buy the soundtrack at your local record shop. And then as the years go on, as the creatives get more control of the cartoons, they kind of became a mixed bag. You know, usually, if the cartoon's more music-focused, then okay, that's Merry Melody, but then you'll have shorts that had music in it that were fond of Looney Tunes. So I think by this point in the 60s, it was very much like, what even is a Merry Melody anymore? And while there would be Merry Melody cartoons after this short came out, one of them, unfortunately, is Banty Raids. Which he sings, one song for 5 seconds. Really? But I think that this short, Nellie's Folly, should be considered the finale to Merry Melodies, because most 90% of the short is operated by music. It's the folk, it's the anchor point throughout it. And that's what Merry Melody cartoon should be, honestly. Should be music is the main focus. And this cartoon greatly exemplifies that. So I certainly thought it'd be the finale to Merry Melodies. And if you say,
I think that's a good theory. You know, I think that, what Merry Melody could they do that could top this one? Nellie's Folly is ahead of its time, man. It's an idea that's aged insanely well, and because it's the story of a freak of nature ruined by a cynical, self-absorbed world that didn't deserve it. And you've seen so many filmmakers do stories like this contemporarily. Like, Bong Joon-ho did a movie like this. Leos Carax did a movie like this a couple of years ago. Nicholas Raig did Man Who Fell to Earth. Isao Takahata did Princess Cayuga. All with very similar themes of this, something otherworldly and rare and mystical and magical coming to this earth and getting corrupted and mistreated and misused. And the heartbreak comes with now the material world wastes the talent of something truly natural and unique. And again, I bet so many filmmakers have been influenced by this one without even knowing it. Now, a lot of my criticism about this are the fact that it's not a pure comedy like a lot of other Looney Tunes classics. It does take a while for it to find the funny and find what's interesting. And there's not a lot to Nellie as a character, which, again, it was hard for men to write women in this era, let alone animals. But there's so much here that's fascinating. And that's eye-opening even now. I mean, no wonder this was nominated for an Oscar. This is a really beautiful story with, you know, great animation, great dramatic work, and a really fantastic ending. And it's a proof that this division could do things that didn't always have to be funny, even though I think it could have used being able to fall back on those laurels a bit more often than it did. I was blown away by this one, even with the flaws I do have with
it. Yeah, that's also what kills me, is, you know, we reach this point in the 60s, and occasionally, especially from the Jones division, but a lot of see what we can really do. We can do this and this and that and this. And it was just the worst timing imaginable. It just, I have all these creative ideas left.
Yeah.
Sorry, we gotta play safe with Daffy and Speedy now. Sorry, you gotta go off to your own thing, which...
Yeah, a new era, and it, you know that, so...
Yeah, which, it's very unfortunate, and I was telling this to you, Jordan, that, you know, 60s Jones is so fascinating, because you can tell by this point he wanted to leave, he wanted to do more creative stuff. And then he gets the opportunity, he does Down on the Line, he does Bear That Wasn't, he does The Grinch, you know, he does all these big risks in a way, and he spends the last couple of years of the 60s doing Tom and Jerry cartoons that are just not as good renditions of his Warner work. It's weird. It feels like he thought he had all these ideas that he could really do without, you know, the help of Warner's, and then he ran through them all in like 3 years or whatever and went, oh, shit. I need money. I need money.
Pretty much.
Tom and Jerry, I'll do them.
The other fascinating thing about this cartoon, and it's mostly just something I find funny, is of the three that we're covering in this episode, this one isn't the one that ends with the It's All a Dream ending. And I think that's funny because Nelly did have a song called Just a Dream. Okay, what are you giving us?
Damn it. Damn it. All right, I'm going to stand. It's not a funny short, but that's sort of the point of it. It's an enthralling story that goes by at a fantastic pace with great levels of animation from the Jones division. I give the short a 4.5 out of 5 anvils.
That's fine. I'm only giving it a 4 out of 5, just from really just what I'm projecting on it for what it should be, which is kind of unfair. But I think this is a fantastic one. And it's another one where if this was a full film, I think this would have been really fleshed out and beautiful and wonderful. And as
man,
it's
if only
really
there was...
Okay. Yeah. No, I,
man, if only there was some sort of feature film by the Chuck Jones Film Division that could demonstrate what he could do with a longer period of time. Anyways, Gay Perry is now coming to the Warner Archive on Blu-ray around this time, I think. So go buy that.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry if I cut you off. I just needed to get that Nelly joke in there. I wrote it down like midway through the beginning of this, right after the first Nelly joke. I thought of it, and I'm like, shit. And I'm like, okay, I have to end with this. So,
All right.
Here we go. Another Froggy Evening was released on October 6th, 1995. Mark, I mentioned this morning that I had another very strange and very wild on this day.
Okay.
On this day, in 1995, Crash Morgan, drummer for the band Big Sugar, which was a Canadian alt-rock reggae-ish band from this period, dies in the middle of a set while performing in Waterloo, Iowa.
Ooh,
at the age of 36.
That's young.
Now, this was not like a band. Like, this was still an up-and-coming band. This was not like a, like, somebody's like 60 years old, you know, shat himself away after fame. No. He's 36. They're still making their way towards the limelight in Canada. They're still in their prime. And he gets a heart attack in mid-set and dies, and they have to find a new drummer. And they still have lots of career after that. And it's fascinating because you've seen bits of this before where a band on the verge of breaking big loses a member and has to, like, you know, improvise. It happened with the Rolling Stones and Brian Jones, or I think that was his name. Or it happened with Rush's original drummer, John Rutsey. You know, they found a medical issue with him. Basically, he didn't want to go on stage or whatever. So in comes Neil Peart. Manic Street Preachers. They have their guitarist went missing, which is something that when I mentioned that to my friend Mick, like when I was setting up, you know, how angry were these Welshmen? Their guitarist went missing, and he laughed for about 10 minutes. Whereabouts still unknown, and they soldiered on without him, and they still dedicate their shows to Richie Edwards, even though, you know, wherever he may be.
Just one of these days.
And so you think...
Just one of these concerts. I have to dedicate this to Richie. Hold on!
Here, there he is! Get him! Tie him down and make him play guitar for us.
Okay, you missed about 30 years of 45 years of material, so just roll along with us.
All right. Learn all the hits from 1998. No, but I mention all that because you have all these bands that lost a member and have some sort of tech. I mean, obviously you see Dave Grohl doing this now by dedicating an entire album to Taylor Hawkins. And so there's some sort of, there's this tact, there's this gentleness. And I set that up because the very next single that Big Sugar put out after this event, after getting a new drummer and everything, the very first single they put out was called Digging a Hole.
Way of putting it.
Maybe they do things different in Canada. Digging a Hole. We just lost our drummer. Here's our song, Digging a Hole. Needless to say, they never crossed over to U.S. appeal.
No, I never heard.
Were you going to play in Digging a Hole?
Oh, I probably am. Because when I hear that song, all I think is of the Beatles fixing a hole.
Yeah. The difference between those two is that for that one, the guy wasn't actually dead, but you thought he
right.
was.
Right.
Whereas, I did a whole fucking research project on that.
Oh, did you confirm it?
Yeah. No. No, Paul McCartney still lives and breathes. For those who aren't aware, there was a whole urban legend in the 1960s that Paul McCartney died in a car crash and was replaced by a guy named William, who was the finalist in a Paul McCartney lookalike contest, and he's been performing as Paul ever since. Needless to say, that's not true, but I did a whole research project on it. But
yes.
Yeah, Digging a Hole. To commemorate the fallen drummer. These things keep landing on our fucking laps, guys. We're sorry. Also, because I did the On This Day number one thing that we do, which I think we've done one from October 95 in a while, because I think these two look familiar. Number one in the US was Fantasy by Mariah Carey. Number one in the UK was Fairground by Simply Red.
All right. Yes.
Advantage Mariah. And then in theaters, you could see Seven, Assassins, and Showgirls if you wanted to.
Wait, I'm sorry. What could you see in theaters?
David Fincher's Seven. The movie Assassins with Antonio Banderas and Sylvester Stallone. And Paul Verhoeven's okay. Showgirls.
Now we get to play my favorite game. Jordan.
First of all,
now was this short released in theaters, Another Froggy Evening?
Well, here's the thing. I don't think it was, but I'm also hearing a conflicting report that it was released in front of City of Angels 3 years later, which I don't think is accurate.
That makes no sense. It's not as fun. So,
yeah,
of those three movies, which one would be more fun with Another Froggy Evening with a Looney Tunes cartoon attached to it?
I mean, are all of them Warner Brothers films?
Are they?
Let me check.
Dude, I don't care.
All right, well, in that case, Showgirls.
I want Showgirls back. No, because like, wasn't the point of Showgirls? I think they did like the Room thing when they're like, no, it's meant to be a comedy, it's meant to be a spoof. By the time they get in, they're like, no, we're serious. I think if they put a Luigi's cartoon in front of it, that probably would give people a better idea what the movie is.
Can you imagine Paul Verhoeven watching the Looney Tunes?
I was always a big fan of the Bugs Bunny. He was good. The thing about the Daffy Duck is not enough explosions and not enough tits.
It's just a moment, Showgirls, where Elizabeth Shue is just...
Elizabeth Berkley.
Where Elizabeth Berkley is just, you know, getting down to it. He cut to the audience, and it's like Chuck Jones is in the club.
He's yelling at the theater of that premiere as well and had to be escorted out.
Wait a minute. Wait. Where's the bathroom? Good job, Chuck. Just stay right there. I'm sorry. I was on my way to meet Joe Dante. I don't know how I wound up here. Like, Chuck, come over here. Joe Dante is also at the club for some reason. They had the business meeting for getting Chuck Jones to do an anime cartoon for Gremlins 2 at the club for some reason.
Hey, for some reason I'm distracted. What's going on over there? Oh no, that's just Paul filming another shitty movie. It happens all the time.
Yes.
Anyway, another Froggy Evening. Chuck Jones directed it. Story credits go to Chuck, Don Ariely, Stephen A. Fassati, and Stan Freeberg.
Yeah.
Huh.
No idea why.
Pete Prum is not in this.
He was just in the office, and I guess Chuck was like, hey, got some joke
jokes. Got any ideas?
Ideas? Well, yeah, Chuck. How about Chase by Lions?
I could do that.
Should I put Pete Puma in there? No. I don't.
I just did that.
Okay.
But yeah, no, this is important because it's a sequel to One Froggy Evening, a film loved by millions and given a 4.5 out of 5 by tens. You know, I think it's a very big deal he would decide to do a sequel to this because obviously they were like, okay, we need... you know, recognizable characters for some of these contemporary Chuck Jones ones. He's like, all right, I'll do a Froggy Evening sequel. And it's a...
I mean,
yeah.
You know Chuck loves this cartoon because like he put it in his movie. It's in the Buzz by Roadrunner movie. And, you know, he was like, no, if I'm going to do another one, I would like to do another one Froggy Evening, which, yeah. You know... if anyone else said that, you'd be laughed off the street, but it's Chuck Jones. He wants to do it, so you let him do it.
So, after the many credits, and the credits are even done to an instrumental Hello, My Baby, one of the great running gags in this, because it's throughout all time, but one of the great gags in this is the little titles that Chuck has. You know, scene one, 300,000 years ago. Scene two, the next morning. And so... what a lot of this is different moments across time where different types of people, all who resemble the man from the original, the unlucky, greedy sword who gets it even unluckier, finding the frog in different times. Like the first one is, you know, the million years BC, the invention of fire, caveman area. And it follows a lot of the same structure as One Froggy Evening, where he finds the frog still in that case, and the frog sings a song. And I love how in this one, he it's just clams.
Millions of them.
Instead of money, just clams. In terms of Michigan J. Frog, I don't know, man. Both in design and vocal quality, this just isn't the same as the original. Because they hired an accomplished vocalist to do this, and... it's not the same.
Hello, my baby. Hello, my honey. Hello, my ragtime cow. Send me a kiss by wire. Baby, my heart's on fire. If you refuse me, honey, you'll lose me. Then you'll be left alone. Oh, baby, telephone and tell me I'm your own.
It sounds like someone else is singing. It doesn't sound like Michigan J. Frog. It sounds like, okay, we got a singer who's doing Michigan J. Frog.
It kind of matches, but yeah, it's definitely different. Which is kind of crazy because, it kind of jumped ahead a bit, I guess. But like, when he does go back into frog mode, I could have sworn that's the exact same sound effect from One Froggy Evening. So, they had the tapes. I don't know. Would that have been too weird?
I don't know. I mean, it would have fit. I mean, they did it with the Paul Julian sounds, and I think they still had some of those audio clips, so I would have been fine if they did, but I understand why they had to do something. It just it sounds off. It sounds like, you know, you don't get the sense from the original where the second he stops singing, he just goes, okay, how's that?
Oh, wait, actually, you know what it sounds like? And it's funny, considering this is 95. It sounds like from the WB.
Yeah, honestly.
It sounds like him. And I believe that's Jeff Bennett. Is that Jeff Bennett?
I don't know.
I don't know, but yeah, you know, I mean, for years they couldn't find the person who actually did Michigan J. Frog in the original short. It wasn't until like recently that they actually did.
Maybe I'm thinking of
Giovanni Jones.
Oh yeah, that was it. Yeah, now Michigan J. Frog. It's like, oh, it's this guy. Got it. You know.
Oh, try it. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Never mind. But
yeah, no, there's a about the difference.
Yes, but next is where we get one of the qualities I really liked about this cartoon is its epicness.
Yes.
We get this moment where the guy builds the
Stonehenge
structure. He builds Stonehenge to have people sit and watch Michigan J. Frog.
Yeah.
And it's very nicely done.
Yeah, they have it set to pictures at an exhibition, which is a really cool music cue. Because George Doherty does the score, by the way. And yeah, no, it's really cool to have the pictures at an exhibition cue.
So the millions of people, they finally come, they sit on Stonehenge to watch Michigan J. Frog. And of course, nothing happens, leading to him to put on the little hat and do the kick dance like you on Friday evening, and it's still as funny.
Yeah, it would have been funnier with the original animation crew, because he dances away only for rocks to be pelted at him, and it doesn't hit as much because it's not as abrupt and it's not animated as well.
Yes, as we cut to the next scene, as he's on a crane covered in bandages.
Yeah,
he just kicks the box underneath, throws the hat down there. As we transition to Rome.
23,264 years later that afternoon.
And great restraint by Chuck to not throw in a...
Roman Legion hair reference?
Yeah, Roman Legion hair reference. Yeah. I don't know. Who wouldn't find it?
Cool.
Just far in the distance. Shut up!
Yeah, lions.
But, yeah, we get the Roman equivalent of the guy. As he stops his horse, he hears Michigan performing the Michigan Rag. He then jumps up, sings the Michigan Rag. Yeah. As immediately he's like, ooh, again, I can make serious money off of this.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but what I really like about this is that the locations are bigger in this.
Yes.
It's the Colosseum.
It's huge.
It's thousands of people. It's like Madison Square Garden.
Yeah.
As they're all waiting. And you're like, hey, here you go. Poof. Opens the thing. Nothing happens.
But yeah, no, it's all really big. And again, it's one of the things I have problems with in the first half is that, like, the first two segments are basically the same. And one honestly should have been cut, and maybe even with the scope, it probably should have been this one, even though it does look big and grand. Like they have, like, you know, Caesar, like Saladus Caesar, they have on the side of his throne, and they have all this very big scope for the Colosseum. But the thing is that the original has a gradual escalation of just one time, and you know the rise and fall, and this is just several quick rises and falls, and it doesn't work as well for me. You know, it's just the same thing happening two or three times. I mean, there are some good things here. Like, I like Michigan flying up to Caesar's box, croaking in midair, and then falling back. But it's the same thing.
Yes, as Caesar downvotes as we cut to the audience filled with the crew who made the cartoon. Chuck Jones is in there, which I liked. I like that Chuck put himself in the cartoon. He isn't one of those people who did that a lot, but that's a lot of fun.
It was cheeky. He's in there, Siskel and Ebert in there. It's great.
I'm sure they got a real kick out of that.
Of course. No, it's not like an unflattering one. Like, you know, like a lot of other cartoons. Like, okay, Siskel and Ebert don't like it either. Of course. You know, that's how they could be used.
As they lift up the doors and lions,
and tigers chase him out, and Pussyfoot's also there.
I love that. Very cheeky.
Nice. That's a nice reference. Now, as he's running from the lions and tigers, just throws the box over the bridge as Mushkin is now floating away to our next era.
Yeah. 1776. I think it's very full circle to have Michigan singing On a Moonlight Bay here, considering, you know, Porky's Duck Hunt back in the day. Honestly, this is one of my favorite rise and fall sequences in the whole thing, because it Chuck knows the last two are the same. He's like, all right, let's make this different. And so the most, again, the man is basically Paul Revere using Michigan to alert the Patriots, going throughout, you know, like, and all of this is set to the song. And I like, you know, him coming down the stairs of the lighthouse and then swimming up and bringing him around. Plus, it's a version of the American Revolution and the version of the Paul Revere running around Boston thing.
That it doesn't suck.
It atones for Old Glory.
Oh my God. Oh my God, that just great. Oh my goodness.
It so does.
It's almost like he knew. It's almost like he knew. It's like, well, not getting younger. Old Glory sucked. I'm going to do that again. Better.
And also, the fact is, you know, it culminates in him running to Washington's house and telling him, the fact we don't even need to see inside of George Washington's house to know what happens, that's an improvement.
It just, you know, the lights turn on, you hear, as we immediately transition to the guillotine. No, well, not to the guillotine, but to the, you know, the...
The gallows or something like that. Yeah, they're all there. They've got their, yeah, the thing. And obviously, Michigan's able to squeeze out of it and go on his way.
Love that.
We go to the last segment, which I was thinking would be more of the same, because it starts with the guy on a deserted island looking to try and cook Michigan, and I thought it was going to be something like more of the same. And just when you think it's going to be more formulaic, a flying saucer arrives, and it's Marvin the Martian.
Oh, goody, goody. At long last, I have captured a perfect specimen of an operatic earthling, Frogius Toadeye. How delightful.
So first of all, Joe Alasky's Marvin here is different from how it would be on Duck Dodgers. He's very much trying to ape Mel's original voice for the character without putting his own spin on it. And said spin in Duck Dodgers would suit him a lot better. This is still a really impressive impression of the original Marvin, of course. So already that is down pat. This is the Marvin of lore, and he's very much examining Michigan as a specimen. The ending reveal that that Marvin can understand what Michigan is saying, and the entire time, whenever Michigan has croaked, what he's been trying to say is, can I sing for you? That is the only reason why no one has ever, you know, the audiences have you know, he hasn't performed, because he always tries to say, hey, can I sing for you? And they never respond. They're waiting for him to do something. And so someone finally responds to that query who understands him. And that's how we lead to this wonderful duet where Marvin and Michigan sing together. And someone finally respects Michigan for his talents. It's almost an exact opposite of the ending of Nelly's Folly, in that he finally finds someone that loves him and can respect him and isn't going to abuse him like the rest of the men who look the same trying to use him for money or for other things. It's the perfect fit, because finally someone understands him and someone realizes how amazing he is. And it's this wonderful duet as they fly off.
We'll find perfect peace where joys never cease, and let the rest of the world go by.
Thank you for that, actually. I was thinking more like, oh, this is also a Chuck Jones creation, Marvin. It's like, oh, it's nice. They have to pal around that space too. Forever. This is nice. But no, that makes...
But this is the one specimen that Marvin is never going to try and kill, because he appreciates how amazing that Michigan Day Frog is. These two fit together. It's the end of Michigan's story at the end of Marvin's story. It is a perfect ending. It is wonderful. And I am glad that we got there after some formulaic beginnings of this cartoon. This, I said it earlier, I think we should have cut Rome, you know, establish the formula, mess with it, and then rupture the formula with Marvin. But it takes too long doing the same thing multiple times. It doesn't work as well as the original, a lot of these. Also, the animation isn't quite, there are some good moments with the animation, but Michigan J. Frog isn't animated as well. There's, it's clearly a smaller unit. This Michigan voice doesn't feel as genuine as the original. I hear a trained singer more than the actual character. The second half makes up a ton of ground. The ending is truly incredible. It makes everything seem worthwhile. This is not a perfect cartoon, but I'm glad it exists.
Yeah, I do like how it's the same guy throughout the years. You know, they very much have done like different people throughout the years, like different corrupt people throughout history. Like Henry Ford gets him, and then like maybe the very last person would be like a caricature of the current CEO of Warner Brothers.
Oh, you're okay.
No. I mean, like, all the time.
Okay.
Like, whoever ran Warner Brothers in, like, 1995. Like, wait a minute, who's the last guy? It's like, it's like, fun. Look, you're a legend. But yeah, I loved the loony inside gangs. It's a very solid premise. I greatly enjoyed this one. I do agree it is lesser than One Froggy Evening. I won't be giving this a higher rating than One Froggy Evening, because people would kill me.
No, neither will I, honestly.
I will say it's nice, like you said, it's nice that we had this. You know, that's what I find very fascinating about the 90s Jones shorts, is that he wasn't dying in the 90s. We could tell, you know, like, hey, I got this second chance to do Looney Productions. I'm probably not going to get it again. I'm going to, you know, do what I would want to do with these characters. Yeah. And if one of them is, I want to do another One Froggy Evening because I really like doing One Froggy Evening, all the power to him. You know? It's a nice that we have it here, and it doesn't, you know, ruin the integrity of the first one.
God, no. It gives it a really nice ending. It finishes that arc really well, even if it's not all as good as that ending. Well, what are you giving it first? Because I'm torn between the two.
All right, I'm giving this short a 3.5 out of 5 anvils.
Yeah, that's what I'm giving it to. I wasn't sure if I was being too harsh, but yeah, it's not a perfect cartoon. It does some things not as well as the original, but that ending is absolutely perfect and deserves all the praise in the world.
It's a very sweet ending.
Wonderful.
Yeah, you don't get a lot of sweet endings from Looney Tunes cartoons. I'm glad that two of these at least are being like, no, it's a happy ending for once. Everybody loves a happy ending.
Yeah, it's a great happy ending.
Let's see what you guys had to say about these three Chuck Jones cartoons.
James Riley at JamesRiley21 says, another Froggy Evening is decent, but it's a retread of its predecessor. It's not the worst sequel, but if you skip, you're not missing anything. Yeah, I agree with you for the most part. A lot of it is very much the same stuff, just done not as well and with different vocals. I do like the ending, though. I think the ending is absolutely perfect, and I think that's at least the one thing that people should try and see if they're thinking of skipping it.
Yeah, definitely. The ending is the best part of it. I think it's a fine short. The best way I could put it, I think I said this to another Looney Tunes short we were watching, but like, it's a good end, like watching Looney Tunes block of Cartoon Network. It's a good ender short to put there before we go into Tom and Jerry, you know? It's good, like, okay, here's a decent 90s attempt by the Looney Tunes crew, and we're going to send you on your way.
Yeah, it's a very feel-good ending, and then you can go right into Tom and Jerry.
Another comment here from Key the Drummer from Fifi, or Fifi, apologies for that. Fife? Drummer from Fife, maybe, yeah. And he was just on an exodus, essentially, of watching every single Looney Tunes cartoon ever released. We tip our hat to you, because, boy, that sounds like a lot. I don't even think we made a dent into our Looney Tunes coverage.
No.
But, man. Which also proves that you can indeed watch all 1,000 Looney Tunes cartoons.
Yeah, people have done it.
He just finished the marathon, 1,000 shorts, 1939. He actually considers Chuck Jones to be a bit overrated overall. Okay, he's great, I never cared for his early or late work. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, fair. He had a sweet spot and he stuck to it. I get that.
Including Rock Goodbye Baby and Nelly's Folly included. He did have a thought about another Froggy Evening, but he does agree that One Froggy Evening is easily one of his best.
Absolutely, I love that one.
Yeah, who wouldn't disagree with you on that?
No, you like it. It's just it's the one
I do. I'm
not yelling at you for not liking it. It's just not thinking it's perfect. It's a different thing. We end with a comment from Spiders Prime 2, frequent commenter. Says his thoughts on Another Froggy Evening. He's grateful for the ending Marvin cameo. He also says, I swear to God, there's a short where Michigan Frog dies and went to heaven. I didn't see it anywhere, but he seems to think that existed. Maybe it's been Mandela affected out of existence. But that does seem like something Chuck would do, though.
The Last Temptation of Michigan.
Oh, God. Didn't we do that gag already?
No. I messaged you this gag when I saw the comment. Just The Last Temptation of Michigan. And it's just Jesus Christ on the cross going, no, guys, I'm telling you, that frog can sing. Look over Michigan. That's it, back on the cross.
Jesus Christ.
Like, how are those nails harder now? How dare you?
And then he just goes back, and Jesus reascends to heaven, and God's like, okay, what happened? He's like, there's this frog. He's like, okay, say no more. I know this. I know this guy. I'm sorry, but this shit happens sometimes. If you want, we'll bring you back as a donkey or something, It'll be,
Yeah, so thank you so much for your comments this week, guys. Yes,
thank you. Thank y'all. Before we get to what we're doing next week, we just want to take this opportunity to thank the people that have subscribed to our Patreon. People such as TriScrew, Andrew, James Irish, Sam Adams, the guy, not the drink. They have helped us out by pledging anywhere from $1 to $5 on our Patreon. And they get perks like being thanked in the middle of an episode, in addition to their commentaries that they get that we record, as well as early access to episodes and handwritten letters from me, and also playbacks of live streams. So if you want to become a patron just like those four that I thanked in the middle of this episode, you can follow our patron at patreon.com/TNQAF.
All right. So for next week's show, this is a weird one.
Yes, it is.
It's a weird one. Okay, so I'm on Looney Twitter one day. And I see, I think it was from Trevor Towns Club, I think. I see, hey, on this day, this Bing Crosby parody short came out. And, it's funny because Bing Crosby was going to sue Warner Brothers for it. And immediately I'm like, I'm sorry, what?
Bing? Like, litigation?
Bing was going to sue Termite Terrace?
Call my lawyer.
And, I looked this up, and this was true. Bing Crosby, noted singer, actor, person, was going to sue Warner Brothers and Termite Terrace. By proxy, Termite Terrace, mostly Warner Brothers. He didn't know that they even existed. For doing these two shorts he viewed to be, slanderous against his character. And because I'm tempted so easily, and because I thought of a fantastic title for the episode, because I love Fall Out Boy so much, for next week's episode, we're going to be covering Bing Crosby's piss-off cartoons entitled Bing Crosby Made Us Change the Title of This Episode So We Wouldn't Get Sued. They're called Let It Be Me, Bingo, Crosbyanna, and because there are only two cartoons, I threw in a third one here called The Mousemerized Cat. Sorry, folks, we're not doing that cartoon. We were instead doing As Cats Can. Back to the end of the episode. Although it also has a Bing Crosby character in it.
It was like a bold strategy, Cotton. Let's see if it pays off.
Exactly. Exactly. And neither of us have seen these shorts.
No.
We don't know. Listen, I'm just in it for the curiosity. What do they have Bing Crosby do with these cartoons? What do they have him do? Is there a scene where he slaps someone? Does he slap his children in the cartoons? Because we know that's, well, not wrong.
That's the sound it made, too. Bing!
So stay tuned for more jokes like that.
Yes, more jokes. Maybe I'll get sued by Bing Crosby's estate.
Oh my god, I would so love to be sued by Bing Crosby's estate. So that's the end of this week's show. If you want to follow us on Twitter, follow me at MarkHalem1995.
You can follow me at TallGuySchmidt.
If I keep up with the podcast or give your thoughts for next week's episode, you'll follow us at that_Looney, both on Twitter and Instagram, or type in the podcast title. We are the first result.
You can also find our podcast wherever podcasts are readily available. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify Podcasts, Player FM, Amazon Music. We have a YouTube channel that we post lots of fun clips from our show on, now featuring the video feeds from our show. You can check those out. There should be a new one of those every week or so, or every couple of weeks, one of those. We've got a lot of fun content coming at you. Also, be sure, if you haven't already, to check us out on Patreon. Maybe give some money there at www.patreon.com/TNQAF.
All right, so until next week, I'm Mark.
And I'm Jordan, and until next time, I will be shaking my tail feather. Good night.